now open a public hearing on House Bill 5033, the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Mr. Shetterly, if you could remind us where we left off on Thursday, I believe it was.
Yes, Wednesday. Seems like just yesterday.
Or Wednesday, yes, yes. All the days run together.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, Director of the Department of Land Conservation and Development. First, Mr. Chair, I hope my tie today suits your taste and style. Red on checked as opposed to, I think it was gray, silver on white.
But blue on.
This is a fashion.
Blue and red always clashes.
When it draws a comment from the chair, I pay attention.
That's right.
Mr. Chair, when we were last before you, we were going through the handout, and we had gotten to page 17. Of the handout. We had covered the first two performance measures. We were going to go through them this morning, through the remainder of the performance measures, and of course, if there's time, we can get into the rest of our presentation, but I thought I would pick up where we left off.
Okay.
Just to remind you that our performance measures are grouped in terms of land supply. Those are performance measures 1, 2, 4, and 9. Assessment of local plans, those are performance measures 3, 5, and 6. Conservation, those are performance measures 8, 10, 11, and 12. Periodic review and plan amendments, performance measures 13, 14, 16, and 18. And customer service being the rest of the performance measures. I'll identify those as we go through, but those are the thematic groupings of the performance measures.
Okay. Mr. Shetterly, what we'll do here is, just like on Wednesday, we'll go through two measures at a time and then take questions.
Okay. That's fine. We'll start with number three then. Number three measures the percentage of cities that have updated their local plans to include reasonable cost estimates and funding plans for sewer and water systems. This measures, of course, the local government's capacity to develop for housing, and also, of course, it relates to economic development, just the ability to be ready to grow and respond to development opportunities. As you can see, we're on target with this measure. There's no changes to the measure. I don't have too much to say about that unless anyone has any questions.
Does anybody have any questions? Jared, let's sneak out for a minute here.
Look up at his door.
Okay.
As with the rest of the rest of what we do, you'll see that what we do in the department is provide grant funds and technical assistance to help local governments achieve this this measure. Number four is the certified industrial sites measure. This is a performance measure that we share with other agencies involved in the certified industrial sites program. As you can see, that program is falling short of the target. Our role in this as the Department of Land Conservation and Development is primarily to address land use constraints on certified industrial sites. Those of you who follow certified industrial sites in that program may know that probably the biggest constraint the state is seeing in certifying industrial sites has to do with wetlands and other physical constraints on the land. The constraints that they're dealing with are not, for the most part, land use related. But since we share this measure with the other agencies involved in the certified industrial sites program, that is reflected as one of our performance measures as well.
If I could just add one thing, or turn to color, Bob Rindy with the department. The targets for this program were set when we first set it up, with no track record at all on how this would work. And so what you're seeing reflected here is that I think they were set more ambitious than the agencies could achieve. And you'll note that we have lowered the targets for 07, 8, and 9, and that just reflects, now that we do have a track record, we have gone through a couple of years of trying to get these sites certified, a realization of how much work it really is and how much effort it takes. So that's just a little context for the numbers changing.
Representative Gerard had a question.
Bob or Lane, the target of 12 is a 40% reduction, despite the fact that you had 13 in 06. That seems to be a target that's awfully low.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I think the thinking in resetting that target reflects that the low-hanging fruit was got during the first couple of years. That is, the sites that were easy, close to transportation, that did not involve wetlands issues and other physical constraints. I think it recognizes that having really picked the low-hanging fruit, it is going to be more difficult to achieve certification on sites as we go through. So I think that's a recognition of what that reset target is. Again, I think that is the same target as the other agencies involved in the Certified Sites Program have, and driven, I think, more by issues not directly related to the land use planning program. But I think the fact is that the easy sites were gotten in the first couple of years, and it's going to be progressively more difficult given the sites that remain.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Additional questions? Seeing none, please.
Okay. Performance measure number 5 is transit-supportive land use. This is a percentage of urban areas with a population of greater than 25,000 that have adopted transit-supportive land use regulations. It really reflects the work through the Transportation and Growth Management Program and the Transportation Planning Rule. We're doing well on this target. In fact, as you can see, just a little bit above our targets, we can anticipate continuing with good performance on this target. Number 6 is transportation facilities, and this is the percentage of urban areas that have updated local plans to include reasonable cost estimates and funding plans for transportation facilities. Again, on target here. But a comment on both of these, going back to my earlier introductory remarks on the performance measures. These really do reflect the work not just of the department, but also of the local governments with which we work. This one in particular that addresses cost estimates and funding plans. That is really exclusively a local government effort, but is one that we support through the Transportation and Growth Management Program through our grants and technical assistance.
Question on number 6. When this addresses local governments, does it include Metro?
Yes, it does.
Okay.
Sure.
Does it include the major projects that would be contained in the Transportation Improvement Plan?
Mr. Chair, I presume, I'm sorry that I am not closely involved with analyzing this one, but what we generally are doing in this performance measure is during periodic review or at other times now, because this periodic review, as you know, we mentioned last time, has been cut back, we are evaluating, just counting those numbers of communities that complete, that do an update of their transportation plan and to include these estimates. And so to the extent that the estimates you're referring to are recent, I wouldn't be able to tell you whether they were in this particular set of numbers or whether they're going to come up next year.
Any additional questions? Okay, so I guess we're 7 and 8.
Okay, number 7, we have a hand in gross change to make on this one. I'll tell you about that in just a second. This is the it's a new one. Percentage of local participants who rank DLCD involvement in the ERT process as good to excellent. As you know, we are a partner agency in the ERT program, and so are called on through ERT projects to be involved when land use issues are engaged in local planning through the ERT team. We had here, because this is new, we originally had TBD, that's to be determined for the targets, working with ERT. We've developed for 2007, 8, and 9 at this point a 66% target. And so where you have TBD in 2007, 8, and 9, that would be 66%. Again, being new, we don't have a target for 2006. And our note there does say that establishment of future targets are still under consideration with the Governor's Economic Revitalization Team, but that's what we're looking at for the immediate future.
Can I hold till we get through 8?
Okay. Number 8 unrelated to number 7, but is a coastal performance measure percentage of estuarine areas designated as development management units in 2000 that retained that designation. This really is directed at how ports are doing, local governments and ports, in maintaining estuary plans that support economic development, and we are maintaining 100% target on that.
I think this should be better.
We'll try.
Representative Dingfelter, then Representative Garrard.
Okay, I'm looking to at the detailed description in the back to see if maybe this is answered. But, Lehner, is every agency that's part of the ERT, are they doing their own individual? I mean, you know, basically, so you're asking somebody who's participated in this process, how did DLCD do? How did DSL, or how did DEQ? Or so they're going to be able to discern one from another agency, even though you guys all work as a team?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelter, that's correct. There is a survey that's been developed that assesses ERT and then includes, it's almost like crosstabs, includes specific questions for the participation of each ERT agency.
Well, you're the first, I think, ERT agency that we've seen this KPM for. So I was just curious if all the ERT agencies are doing that. So, okay, thank you for that clarification.
Yes, Representative Brown.
Thank you. Lane, on number 8, it says percent of estuarine areas designated, blah, 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 blah. How many estuarine areas are designated as development management units?
This is a measure of the ones that have been designated that retain that designation. Do you have the detail on that?
I'm sorry, Chair Representative Garrard. I don't know the exact number, but we can get that for you. What this is counting is land within those estuarine development units that is zoned for, example, deep port or industrial uses. And there is pressure to convert that kind of zoning or lands in that category, for example, to residential or other uses, and that's what we're trying to guard against. And this measures our success in saving those sites for ultimately for industrial development.
But Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, we have that. We can get that number with probably before the end of the day, and be glad to get that to you.
Well, since you're follow, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Since you're hitting 100%, obviously you're doing remarkably well. But if there's only one, that makes it a little difference. So.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, they're up and down the coast.
Oh, okay.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Number 9, natural resource inventories, again measuring what's happening at the local level. This is a percentage of urban areas that have updated buildable lands inventories to account for natural resource and hazard areas. It's a low target, but you can see we're on target roughly with this. This one is one that will be substantially affected and has been by periodic review. This really, I think, ties in with the program largely in Goal 5 and the degree to which local governments are maintaining natural resource and hazard areas. That would be Goal 7 and hazard areas in their planning, coordinating that with their buildable land inventories. Again, so we're on target with this one, I think, understanding that given the challenges, particularly with Goal 5, this will likely continue to be a fairly low target.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, what happened in here on this is that up until the, I think it was the 01 or 03 session, periodic review, a large number of local governments were focused on inventories of Goal 5 resources such as wetlands and other things that make land not buildable. The legislature changed the focus of periodic review through legislation that was adopted that targeted periodic review from henceforth on issues that are not necessarily Goal 5 related or that are much less so. And so that's why we've reduced this target with anticipation that that periodic review is going to focus far less on this topic in the future.
And, Mr. Chair, on this one, too, I think you'll find that the large urban areas, probably Metro 441 being an example, I think also Eugene Springfield, are probably more sophisticated as a rule in terms of their natural resource and hazards planning relative to their buildable land inventories. It's important to note that this one is a percentage of all urban areas. That means all 242 cities. And so it takes into account from Granite and Greenhorn on up to the Portland metro area. So that's why this percentage does not equate necessarily to certainly population areas that would be affected in these kinds of planning considerations, but it's a measure of all 242 urban areas in the state. Although as of Oregon, as of the end of the fiscal year, I think that would have been 241 because Lapine didn't get incorporated until November of last year. Number 10, percent of farmland outside urban growth boundaries zoned for exclusive farm use in 1987 that retains that zoning. We're on target as a measure of zoning. I think this is one that we will have to watch on the ground. There's a Measure 37 component to this. As you know, Measure 37 does not change the zoning of property. It changes the use that's permitted on the property. And so if you have a 100-acre piece of exclusive farm use land in rural Oregon that is developed at urban densities under a ballot measure 37 claim, that 100-acre land would still retain its zoning as EFU. And so this measure does not reflect the impact of ballot measure 37 claims. And so in the future, depending on where we go with measure 37, it may be worth looking at this measure so that it's measuring something useful. At this point, not having seen the extent of development under measure 37 that might be indicated by the number of claims out there, I think this measure is still good. But if we see development actually beginning to occur, certainly on a broad scale, on EFU land under ballot measure 37, we may need to take a look at revising this measure so that it really tells you something useful.
Before we go to questions on number 10, I think there'll be several, but can we try to keep the questions focused on the operation of DLCD? Representing Felter.
Well, I thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to follow up that I think it would be really useful to have a measure that looks at actual conversion of use. And I note that in your more detailed description in the back, you say that the rate of conversion of farmland to other uses is based upon reports of land use applications approved by counties. I mean, the rate of conversion, I think, would be a very useful measure. This doesn't really tell us that much, except, yeah, we're doing a good job at keeping it in EFU. But so I really think that we should, I mean, this is the time where we want to start measuring it, because as these claims come in and that use changes, we want to be able to have some comparison. And you guys are probably tracking that already, I'm assuming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Dingfelder. We are beginning to. We just adopted a rule, I should say the commission just adopted a rule earlier this year that clarifies the requirement of counties to provide the department with notice of land use actions that implement Measure 37 decisions. Before, we didn't have that. And so we will be getting those applications and we'll be able to build in a database. That will tell you the applications that are coming in. Of course, we don't have a way to, except for curbside viewing, to actually see what actually gets developed. But I think it's fair to assume that if someone is putting in an application, they're probably proceeding to development. So we'll be able to track that. And then depending, again, on what the legislature does with ballot measure 37 or not, we may be looking at either a new performance measure to recommend or perhaps an amendment to this one to actually track use as opposed to zoning, because that's going to become much more relevant if Measure 37 goes forward.
When you try to determine this number, Lane, in that a claim may be for 10 acres, 100 acres, 1,000 acres, but yet the conversion to use would only affect perhaps a few acres that would actually wind up being developed. Is there a mechanism in place for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, there should be, because what we have been, what we will be getting notice of now from the counties will be the actual development applications themselves. And those development applications will be more specific than the Measure 37 claims.
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, I talked a little bit to Ron Eber about this same question a few days ago, and he pointed out that indeed this could be something that could become very complex for us to try to determine, because many times a claim may just involve one house on a property. So if we in the future move towards changing this measure or a different measure that measures the actual use on farmland, we're going to have to make some sort of, perhaps arbitrary, perhaps not, kind of a way to say at this point the Measure 37 development has resulted in a use that threatens this property as farmland, but many, many of those would not. And how we're going to sort that out, I have no idea yet. But that's part of the problem here.
You're on top of it.
Yeah.
Yes, I think I was Representative Clem, didn't I? And then Senator Nelson.
This may be too logistically difficult, actually, this question I've got. This has to do with use under the current zoning separate from Measure 37. Let's say we didn't have Measure 37 at all. I have heard arguments that there are things that are zoned out there, you know, incorrectly in their mind, that they're not really usable, you know, based on soil type for what we would call farmland. I don't know logistically, except for the curbside method, again, how we would know what is being underutilized in the zone. But, you know, that's sort of a counterpoint to the Measure 37 part, is if there really is land out there that is zoned for a use that, for whatever reason, it's not being used that way, then I think over in Department of Ag, you know, we need to have efforts to help people bring that into, you know, to bear, whether it's, you know, programs that help develop the farm economies a little bit more so people can use it more effectively and make money doing it, or helping, you know, clear land that has a lot of rock in it and you know, it won't when that's done and then it can be used. But I think there is a larger issue besides just Measure 37 about when the valley is good farmland and people can't profitably or don't know how to use it, the state probably could assist.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, if I can just comment on that. Yes, I think it's interesting. You're suggesting more a qualitative evaluation. That's probably beyond the expertise of DLCD and maybe more in the Department of Ag. This is really quantitative. It looks at the map and accepts the zoning designation across the state that has been imposed by counties designating land as EFU and just measures those acres. It doesn't get into a qualitative evaluation of those. And again, I don't think we have the expertise to do that, but it'd be something I suppose to have a conversation with the Department of Ag about.
Mm-hmm. Senator Nelson.
Follow up to that, in some respects, my question is, it seemed like we had testimony from the Department of Ag that there's like 65 million acres in the entire state of Oregon. 17 million is classified as agricultural use. 4 million of that is classified as cultivatable agro uses. What are these percent of farmland? How much farmland are we looking at here? I think this goes back to a question somebody else asked. How much farmland are we actually talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, again, in the qualitative or the quantitative sense of this is all farmland outside urban growth boundaries designated as EFU. That is the classification. I am sure you're going to get into qualitative differences between high-value, non-high-value, and in some cases perhaps even miszoned land. This doesn't measure that. This accepts the county designation in each case as EFU and measures it on that.
Number, excuse me, Mr. Chair, follow up. Is there a number? How many acres are we actually talking about as classified as exclusive farm use in the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I'm not sure the number of acres. I think it is about 96% of private land that rural private land that's designated EFU.
96%. I'm just thinking, excuse me, Mr. Chair, federal government owns what, 55%?
Roughly 53, I think.
50 something. So we're talking about 90%
40 cents. Is that kind of the figures we're hanging on? What I'm trying to get is how much land are we actually talking about with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, a lot. I mean, really, the state has, of course, urban areas designated within urban growth boundaries. Outside of that, you have EFU and farm forest and forest zones, as well as some rural residential and the occasional pocket of rural industrial. But of the, and we'll get you those numbers. It's an easy breakdown. We can get it to you again very, very, very quickly. But it is the substantial majority of rural land that is designated as EFU.
To some extent, isn't the EFU designation both, well, isn't it when those designations were made almost a default designation, that if it wasn't zoned, if it wasn't zoned inside an urban growth boundary or zoned for rural development, or what happened in the late 70s, early 80s, a lot of exception lands, then its designation was EFU.
Mr. Chair, I think some counties probably were more rigorous than others in terms of their specific designation of lands, but I think that did happen in several counties across the state, that after they got done with everything else, what remained was designated as EFU. Did you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the zoning was based on actual soil maps, and so on the west side, class 1-4 land was zoned EFU, as you say, as a default, and 1-6 on the east side, and then soils that didn't fall into those categories generally were designated as non-resource or land, and then finally lands that were in those soil categories but had been in some manner developed or divided so they couldn't be farmed. Those were the million or so acres of exception lands that were put better still on comprehensive plan maps.
Yes.
Did you find it? Figured out 15.5 million acres are classified as EFU.
Thank you. That's where we would have looked.
That's why I combined my books. I know, I was
thinking about that. It's a recovery fumble.
An additional question I would have, it actually, even though we haven't got there, applies to both 10 and 11. And while on a statewide basis, it wouldn't change the percentages very much at all, infinitesimally. This is basically conversion outside urban growth boundaries. So as urban growth boundaries are expanded, they're not part of this in a sense because they're no longer considered outside of urban growth boundaries. So you could actually take in EFU land that was clearly of a very high agricultural production capability, and you wouldn't affect this. You might actually increase this percentage in a sense because it would no longer be counted because it was outside. It's now inside the urban growth boundary.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. If you think about it, one of the theses of the planning program was the maintenance of rural lands for rural uses, but it also contemplated that urban growth boundaries would expand and would expand onto rural lands. And so this measure really does look at that external component. We have another measure coming up that is measure 12 that looks at the percentage of land added to urban growth boundaries that's not farm or forest. So we do the system does recognize that as urban growth boundaries expand, they will expand onto farm and forest lands to some degree. And you're right, those aren't taken into account in this measure.
Mr. Chair, they may be. I will get back to you on this. Mm-hmm. I think the number number 10 does reflect that, and it is a small percentage of 15 million acres. But yeah. I believe that is in there, and I'll get back to you and verify that. But I think it is.
Anything additional? Now on to 11 and 12.
Number 11 is a lot like number 10. It measures the percentage of forest lands that continue their designation. Again, not surprisingly, the target, the performance is very similar to that of farmland, again, with the same caveat as we had on number 10 with regard to Measure 37 claims. Certainly we're seeing large Measure 37 claims on forest lands, but as with EFU, those claims, if they ever develop, would not constitute a change in the zoning designation of those lands, and so would not be reflected in this particular performance measure. So we will be looking at this one the same as number 10 as measure 37 goes forward in one form or another. Number 12 is the one that we were just talking about, and that is the percentage of land added to urban growth boundaries that is not farm or forest land. As you can see, this target is falling, this measure is falling below the target, and really I think what that reflects as much as anything is the fact that when it comes to adding land to urban growth boundaries, and we're seeing a increase in the number of cities in the last couple of years that are adding land to their urban growth boundaries, Metro being a good case in point in the last go-round, it's getting harder to do that without expanding onto farm and forest land. Particularly in the Metro example, I think is one that the chair would be most familiar with. You know, the exception land is pretty well gone as far as expansion areas of any size. And so you are really faced with the fact that if you're going to grow, it is going to have to be on farm and forest land. So I don't know that this measure is, that our reporting here is a measure of failure. It's really a measure of reality. That is, cities, particularly in the valley, but not exclusively in the valley, where we're located in the middle of farmland, whenever you expand a boundary, there's a high likelihood that that's going to include certainly farmland and forest land too. This may be one that we would want to review in the years to come to see if that target is appropriate going forward. My expectation is that we will probably see failure of local governments to attain that 55% target just because as exception lands are used in urban growth boundary expansions, it's just going to become more and more likely that they grow onto farm or forest land.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair, going on then to number... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yeah. Representative Klein.
I can't recall exactly whose proposal this was, but somewhere in all my Measure 37 related letters, it might have been an agency proposal, it might have been a constituent writing me, somebody talked about a system of essentially potentially trading development rights outside of a UGB in good farmland area for you know, other places where we ideally want building in maybe another part of the state. So not necessarily, you know, all, you know, just right outside Cordon Road, you trade for something down in South Salem in the UGB, but in order to gain value, does that really even happen where there would be land inside of a UGB somewhere else where for some reason they can't build, but if you created a system of development rights trading, you instantly could? Or if you're in a UGB, it's fairly like you're going to be able to build anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clements, interesting discussion. That's you're talking about a concept of transferable development rights that is used, I think, to a fairly small degree in some localities in other parts of the country, where it is just that someone acquires development rights proximate to a city in trade for protections that they place on property outside or away from the city. Frankly, Oregon's system of urban growth boundaries complicates that a little bit because once you're in a UGB, you're presumed to have the right to develop. Where it's been talked about here in Oregon, and you mentioned it in your question there, at least I think in 2001 after the passage of Measure 7, there was some discussion about, I think just what you suggested, maybe creating new development areas entirely so that somebody who might have had a development right under, let's say, a Measure 37 on the edge of the Salem urban growth boundary in order to preserve the integrity of the growth boundary and the farmland immediate outside of that maybe the state could create a receiving zone somewhere in Deschutes County or Crook County, and what they would get would be a development right in this newly designated new urban area. It's extremely complicated, and I know the discussions in 2001 didn't go much farther than the conceptual stage, and I've heard some conversation about it even in the follow-up to Measure 37, but again, it gets awfully complicated to do on a statewide basis, to transfer those rights so far in geographical terms.
Yes.
And the reason I'm asking is because of trying to figure out, you know, this goal, I think you're right, is going to keep moving, or the actual is going to keep moving further and further away from the target. While you were talking, I recalled there was a general statement that I was describing. Someone else also talked to me about something in Jefferson County where there's 200 units and so many allowed to be built per year, but if you're not in the, at any point you can take your development right if you own one of those units and go build somewhere else nearby that's actually ideal. Maybe I could get you the letter originally too.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, In Deschutes County, this is the only place in the state where I'm aware this actually was done as part of a regional, as a special project that we call Regional Problem Solving Project. I think it was in about 2000. The county set up a transfer development rights program for Lapine. And the area surrounding Lapine is divided into large number of rural lots with very shallow water table. Be a health hazard if all of those were to develop. They set up the city of Lapine in an area to receive those, to transfer those development rights into an urban area that would have sewer and water systems. And of course, we had the incorporation. And I'm not aware of all the details of how well the transfer development right project has worked up there, but you might be able to get that information, or we could get it for you from Deschutes County.
Again, Mr. Chair, a case in point, I think where the localized application of that works to solve a local issue. On a statewide basis, it does become much more complicated to administer.
Yes.
Just to add a comment, some of Lapine is in Klamath County, some of Lapine is in Deschutes County. It sets right on the county line, and that creates all kinds of wonderful land use problems in that if you approve something for one area, it may have application to just one county, but it could have application to two county zoning. So,
Mr. Chair, actually closer to where we are, Salem is in the same situation, on this side of the river being Marion County, on this side being Polk County. Yeah, it complicates life, but we muddle through.
As by way of a comment in terms of conversion of land, I think one of the hardest things for people to understand, I think there are vast differences of opinion on land use in the state, but in the metropolitan area, if you might comment, the history of the urban growth boundary is more focused on the efficient use of land inside, never that the boundary itself would be static, that it would never change. I mean, some people have the perception that an urban growth boundary is simply there permanently, and that nothing will ever change outside of it. And if you look at the population estimates for the metropolitan area, there's no way you can avoid, even if you have the most efficient use, of expanding the boundary.
Mr. Chair, that's a good observation. I think there is a misperception in quarters that the land use program is a no-growth policy. It's not. Expansion of urban growth boundaries is explicitly a part of the program. What it is a planned growth program so that the growth that occurs is done rationally and, as you say, with emphasis on efficient use of the land that's available inside an urban growth boundary, but recognizing that there are situations when that land is fully occupied and developed, or where population exceeds the capacity inside, that urban growth boundaries are going to expand. So I think it is a good point that we do not have a no-growth program here, that it really is a planned and managed growth program I think is a salutary effect in helping local governments maintain efficient services to the areas that they do bring in and develop. And it has the corollary benefit of maintaining a rural lands program as well outside those urban growth boundaries. Although I think if you hear from the Department of Ag, they feel the agricultural community, I think, always feels like they're just sort of holding their land sometimes in a land bank for that ultimate urban growth boundary expansion, and it's frustrating to them. But it's that continuous tension between managing for growth and trying to preserve what we have in the way of rural lands and a rural economy.
Mr. Chair, I also note that the big look, which we haven't talked too much about yet, but the Senate Bill 82 Task Force on Land Use Planning, this is one of the central issues that work group is focusing on. And indeed, having been around when that legislation was first crafted, I know that it was one of the core reasons for trying to have this look was frustration on part of many that the perception of urban growth boundary has changed over the years, and there we no longer know exactly the best way to simultaneously expand urban areas for growth and protect farmland, and I think that's one result we expect from that group next year.
Well, I think, as it'll be my last comment off of a budget, as a person who's been involved in land use activities since about 1982, I've constantly had to deal with the dichotomy of the same individuals not wanting infill development in their neighborhood and also not wanting the urban growth boundary to expand.
Mr. Chair, I've heard it expressed this way, that if there's anything Oregonians hate more than density, it's sprawl. Or you can say just the opposite, and it's still true. That's right.
Very true.
So,
Mr. Chair, as we expand urban growth boundaries in the future, you'll note more and more that we're trying to, for example, put in land more and more for industrial sites. It's almost always large flat land. It's got to be farmland. As we try to expand urban facilities, cities have noticed that it's increasingly difficult to annex areas that are already developed. And as that happens, that's also creating a pressure for urban growth boundaries to grow onto farmland.
Yes.
I just add one more thought to this, I guess, theoretical discussion about urban growth boundaries. I do think that they serve in part a no-growth standard, in that it allows us some breathing time to decide which lands we do not want to move into. As an example, the encroachment around Forest Park in the Multnomah County and part of Washington County areas. And there's discussion in Metro now about what I would consider a no-growth standard on the encroachment of Forest Park, which means then you want to look to other areas. And it's a very important concept, because it's what did not happen, for instance, in South San Francisco 40 years ago, as they started to sprawl out and didn't have a good planned a method of deciding what areas they were not going to go into. And I think our growth boundary does allow for that analysis.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vaca, I agree with that, and I think it's probably a matter of semantics. I would say that in the context, recognize that an urban growth boundary is the entire ring around an urban area. If the city is going to designate an area around to which it does not intend to go, such as Forest Park, they're implicitly acknowledging that they will be moving the boundary elsewhere. And so I think that really is the planned growth aspect that our program serves. That gives cities and local communities an opportunity to look at and think rationally about areas before they just start laying streets and developing. So we're 100% agreement with that.
Go on.
All right. Number 13 is periodic review remands. This is the percentage of periodic review work tasks that are returned by the department to local jurisdictions for further action. You'll see that we've adjusted the measure going forward to, I think, a more realistic standard. It's unlikely to expect that zero periodic review work tasks would be returned to local jurisdictions for further action. That would assume that either everybody is getting everything exactly right, or that we're not looking very closely at what comes in. And I think what we've got here is a record over the past 3 years, and then adjusting that as a target going forward is probably a more reasonable expectation. We work very closely with communities on their work tasks in periodic review, and I think that is a good standard. And in fact, the reality is that sometimes a work task that is submitted to the department, reviewed, and then sent back for further work really represents a better outcome both for the city and the community. So it's not, this is not a bad standard at all, and I think if we can get to and maintain around about 15%, that's a good balance between the expectation that we would be out there providing technical assistance to help cities and counties with their work tasks, and also recognizing that sometimes that process of collaboration means submitting something, some work on it, being returned for further work. So I think we're good to go on this one going into the future.
Quick question, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Lane, what are you really measuring here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrard, this would be evaluation of work tasks submitted by local governments for compliance with state law, for instance, goals, statutes, administrative rules. That would be the basis for the evaluation of the work tasks submitted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Clem.
Mr. Chair, and I think I probably just have some education to continue to do for myself, but would on what all would, might be included in periodic review, because it sounds like it could be a variety of different things, but is the 20-year buildable supply inventories, is that part of periodic review? Or could it be?
Typically. Yeah. You want to answer it? Typically it is.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Clinton, a large, more and more periodic reviews are all about the urban growth boundary. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that way in the early years, but now more than ever.
I had a question about that buildable supply inventory. When it's calculated, does it just look at, physical acres and land, or do we have some sort of way, like in Salem downtown, for example, we're starting to go up. Everything I hear about now is retail on the bottom, condos on the top. And do we count air in the buildable land as you're moving up, or not so much?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, yes, the requirement for urban growth boundary expansion requires that a local government first determine what their 20-year need is and then determine whether that can be provided within land that's already in the urban growth boundary, which means to examine, for example, the degree to which zoning should change to allow higher density. And when that is done, only then would the local government take the next step and find land outside the boundary to add.
But Mr. Chair, we don't have a state standard that requires cities to develop vertically. Often that's a choice of local governments. Frankly, it's less expensive to provide services to, and I think local governments will, and frankly, the market will be moving in that direction. We see the success in the Portland area of that kind of development. In Salem, they're looking at Meridian as being sort of their test case on that. And demographics are moving us in that direction. The market is moving us in that direction. And happily, it works very well with the Oregon Land Use Planning Program that emphasizes efficient use of land inside urban growth boundaries. We don't require it, but to the extent that cities are able to maximize space inside the UGB by vertical development, then that just takes pressure off of the expansion.
Try to get through 14 and 15.
Okay. Number 14 is just a measure of percentage of DLCD concerns, recommendations regarding local plan amendments that are provided to local governments within the statutory deadlines. We have deadlines for providing comments to local governments when they submit plan amendments. And as you can see, our target is 100% in responding to those within the statutory time frame, and we are achieving that. Number 15, grant awards. Percent of grant awards to grants awarded to local governments within 2 months after receiving the application. Our target, as you can see, we're making progress toward the target substantially over the last couple of years. We didn't get there this year. In part, I would say that's attributable to the Measure 37 demand workload, where for a good part of the biennium we have had even our grant management staff working on Measure 37 claims. But I do commend them for, in spite of that, still moving the bar higher toward the attainment of the goal. And I'm pleased to see that we're making progress on that one.
Representative Ryan.
I'm sorry.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair. This agency 5 years ago was pretty messed up, but I want to give Director Shetterly a lot of credit because since he was appointed, he's come in. These are goals that we're seeing now that, Lane, you have really done a remarkably good job in turning some areas in this agency around in the right direction, and you deserve credit.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Grant, I appreciate that very much. That's very kind of you. I'll commend the staff. We've got a hard-working bunch of folks over there, and I understand there are policy differences in terms in some quarters, but in terms of the work that gets done, they're committed and dedicated and hard-working folks.
I might take this opportunity. Representative Grove, were you finished?
Yes.
I might take this opportunity just to ask you to briefly explain the grant program, because I know that we may have some public comments tomorrow on it.
Mr. Chair, sure, I'm glad to do it. The land use planning program, I'll kind of start at the high level here. The land use planning program was established as a partnership between the state and local governments. It clearly included state mandates and requirements on local governments to do certain things. Those were originally set in statute, and of course, as we know from our overview, the legislature directed LCDC to adopt the goals that would guide the land use planning program and then to adopt administrative rules that implement the statutes and the goals. And so there is a regulatory framework at the state level that directs to a degree how local governments are to execute their local land use planning. Recognizing that that places a burden on local governments now that have to comply with state requirements, the state program established two things to help assist local governments in meeting those state requirements. One is the technical assistance that's provided by department staff, and we've talked about that being our regional representatives that are out statewide and working in county courthouses and city halls across the state, as well as our statewide specialists who provide consulting services from Salem. So there's that technical assistance element, but also there is a fiscal component of state assistance that local governments need, and I think the state, frankly, owes them in order to implement the requirements of the state program. And so the grant program is the fiscal side of that partnership, and we provide grants to local governments under several iterations. In the coastal zone, we have a more robust grant program because there are federal funds available, and so we provide technical assistance grants. We provide planning assistance on a competitive basis, and in fact, in the coastal zone, we even provide grants for projects that actually get built, primarily to provide access to coastal areas. In the rest of the state, our general fund grant program provides general assistance both on a flat basis. We have a very small grant program that goes out to every city, regardless of size, and then we have a competitive grants program that is intended to provide money to cities to pay for consulting services if they're going to do an urban growth boundary expansion and they need a 20-year housing buildable lands inventory, if they're going to do an update of their economic development plan and they need a consultant to help them develop an economic opportunities analysis. If they're in periodic review and they are looking to the state to provide them with financial assistance to meet the state requirements of periodic review, those grants are available as well. In the Columbia River Gorge counties, that would be Multnomah, Hood River, and Wasco counties, we have a specific designation of grants. You won't find it in the budget, but it's through our Grants Advisory Committee. There used to be a budget note on it. We've carried that forward even since the budget note went away. A special set of grants to those counties because they have the extra layer of the Gorge Act that requires particular planning that's not applicable to the rest of the state. And so cities and counties statewide apply to the department for those kinds of planning assistance grants. We are every biennium oversubscribed in terms of our ability to provide those grants, but we do it on a competitive basis, and our regional staff serves as grant reviewers and grant managers. There's one other area of grants that we administer, and those are through our Transportation and Growth Management Program. Those are not general fund grants, but those are funded through our TGM dollars that provide assistance particular to TGM projects, including what we call our quick response program that gets involved with actual developments where transportation needs have been identified. It's a big part of the program. Frankly, I wish it was bigger. I think the state owes it to local governments, since we do have a state element of mandates to local governments in terms of what we expect them to do, to provide them with the grant assistance to do that. So we do that as best we can through our grant program. I would say that our grant program also is administered or reviewed through a grants advisory committee that includes local government representatives, private sector representatives, special districts, and the like, that help us each biennium establish priorities for our grants program based on the grant allocation that's made to us by the legislature.
Clarification on the general fund grants, specifically the ones that are non-competitive. What proportion of the amount that's in the budget for those grants are the non-competitive, and is there a formula used for that that has like a minimum and then a per capita portion, or is it just a flat grant per jurisdiction regardless of size?
Oh, Mr. Chair, it's a good question.
You can answer it tomorrow if you
Well, let's see if I get a quick one here. I'm looking in.
It looks like it's not based on population.
No, we're almost.
On page tab E of the appendix is a list of all the general fund grants, and they're almost identical, so I'm assuming it's not based on a formula because they're about $1,000 for each city.
There we go. Thank you.
You mean to answer for you?
No, I appreciate it. I was going there.
There are a few counties that have, obviously counties get more money because it looks like they're at $3,500.
That's correct. And then, Mr. Chair and Representative Dinkfelder, if you, this really does, this will, this gives you a picture of the grants. The 1,000 per for cities smaller than 2,500 population and counties under 10,000 for general planning support. And then in the lower right-hand corner of that page, you have the grants that I was referring to that go out to the Columbia Gorge, scenic area counties. Those, again, are it's a special category of grants that we make to those three counties to recognize the particular requirements they have implementing the National Scenic Area Act. And then on the back, you'll see the other grants, periodic review grants having gone out to those jurisdictions in the 2005-07 biennium, Hood River County, Central Point, Lane County, Ontario, Prineville, and Wilsonville. And then the technical assistance grants, going out to communities that are engaged in work outside of periodic review. Those would be perhaps economic opportunities analyses, buildable lands inventory for an urban growth boundary amendment outside of periodic review, other things that these communities have submitted in the way of grant applications that have been awarded by the department. So this gives you a good picture of the spread of the kind of grants that we do.
Thank you, Mr. Shetterly. That gives them a good overview for tomorrow.
Okay, that's right.
When the testimony.
I have a question regarding this, though, and I was looking to see historically. I mean, $1,000, you know, is sort of a drop in the bucket, and that'll buy, you know, a few hours of consultant time or of staff to compensate staff time, or maybe pay for an intern or something. But so I guess I'm curious, has historically, has that changed over time, or do we have like a CPI, or it's pretty much we've just sort of said here's $1,000 to offset your costs, and then if you want, you know, if you have specific needs, you apply for the technical assistance grants.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dinkfelder, I don't know when that was last changed. It's not adjusted. It's not set on a CPI, and in some cases it would be a token amount. I would say in some of these smaller communities, it's probably more than that. I imagine $1,000 for planting assistance to spray is probably a fair contribution. Clearly, it is minimal, I think, but it does reflect the choice we have to make between providing some, at least, token contribution to local planning efforts while retaining enough in our general fund grants allocation to provide for those Gorge counties and the larger periodic review and technical assistance programs. Obviously, if we increased those outright grants to those smaller cities, that would reduce the amounts available for the technical assistance and periodic review as well as the Gorge counties.
And just so that the members of the committee don't get the perception that the metropolitan area has no small communities, I have the second smallest incorporated area in the metropolitan area with approximately about 305 people, approximately 150 households, River Grove, and it actually has no tax levy, no property tax levy, and it depends solely upon state shared revenue to operate. So
they don't get a grant. Have to fix that, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think they have planners either.
No, they've had it. They have honestly had issues though, because they do have some undeveloped land inside the urban growth boundary. They have a lot of other issues, but that's a different discussion. Like not having a sanitary sewer system.
Mr. Chair, I do want to point out, and you mentioned earlier, you'll probably hear much more about this tomorrow. I haven't seen this graft over the 30-year program, but the general, you will, and may even hear some of this from people with actual numbers, but in general, the amount, the grant support for this program has, over the long term, has decreased. That's what we're seeing. We're continuing to see that.
And Mr. Chair, just as long as we're back on the back tabs, if you wanted to look at the coastal grants, again, those are not general fund, but those are behind tab F. I do think, again, it's a significant responsibility of the state to local governments to provide as much assistance as we can. Since it is a state program, we do that through technical assistance, and the grants obviously back that up as well.
Clarification here, just for potential future use. On the coastal grants, what is the source of those grants? I believe you said it's federal.
That's
and
correct.
Could they be used for planning that was related to seismic issues? I'm going to find some money somewhere.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to guess that first of all, the answer is they are federal dollars. They come to the Coastal Zone Management Act. And in terms of seismic, certainly natural hazards planning is an element, is a component of the planning program. So I am guessing that, appropriately stated, a grant that would address planning for seismic events and other natural hazards in the coastal program could be funded by these coastal grants. Yeah. Okay. I think then we're on to number 16, that is land use appeals, the percentage of agency appeals of local land use decisions that were upheld by LUBA and the courts. As you know, Mr. Chair, we are not LUBA, although commonly we are confused with LUBA. The department can be, in some cases, a party before the Land Use Board of Appeals. And when we appeal a local land use decision, we do become an appellant, and this measures how many of those appeals that we take up are upheld, indicating that we were correct in making the decision to appeal. As you can see, during the fiscal year for which there was no appeals to report on, I will say that in the current, this is just looking ahead, in the current fiscal year, I think we have four or five appeals currently that we have filed since this reporting period expired, principally relating to local government decisions that were made to implement ballot measure 37. So it's really a measure 37 related issue and one in Umatilla County, and that appeal will not appear on this report because that appeal was withdrawn or I should say that land use decision was withdrawn by the county, so that appeal will not go forward. But anyway, in this reporting period, no appeals to report.
17.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. Just a question. Lane, what happened at the end of 03 when your appeals went from 67 to 0? You had to have made a change somewhere.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gore, that 67%, yeah, which might have been 2 out of 3, I'm not sure, but I don't know. I wasn't here in 2003. Do you know the...
I don't remember the numbers, but they were on that order. It might have been 3 or 4.
Okay. I forgot that was a percentage.
Yeah.
You would have had significant AG charges.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, number 17, this is we had a first-time ever customer service survey done. And frankly, I was pleased with the outcome of it. The results of that customer survey established the targets, since this was our first time out of the gate. The numbers here reflect the number of responses that rated customer service as good or excellent. This is somewhat like but different from the earlier ERT measure. In the ERT measure, it was a survey that addresses particular ERT team projects and then asks how did the department do as a member of the ERT team in those projects. This is a survey of our work outside of ERT. It covers everything that we do. And again, I was pleased with the initial results of this. I think it indicates a substantially high level of satisfaction with the work that we're doing, but by the same token, leaves room for improvement and growth. So I think that's a good place for us to be. Mr. Chair, number 18% of periodic review work tasks that are under review at DLCD for no longer than 4 months. Again, we're doing well with our target there. There was a reduction of that target that reflected in, again, in part, as it indicates on the sheet here, a measure of the impact of the Measure 37 workload. And, frankly, I think we do have a call out a particular element here that in some cases a longer time for reviewing a work task submittal can be of benefit to a local government that provides additional opportunity to resolve issues. It's certainly better to take an extra month or two, if that's the case, than to pull the trigger and go into the appeals process. So where we can, we continue. Where there is a prospect of working out an issue with the local government, we would prefer to take the time to do that than just to push it onto an appeal. So I think this is an appropriate target, and I'm pleased to see that we're meeting it.
Any questions? Seeing none, we'll go on to the next.
Number 19, Measure 37. This is the percentage of Measure 37 claims assigned to the agency that are processed within 180 days. Again, the fiscal year report being 100%. I will tell you that there was one claim that we missed within the last couple of months. It was an interesting one. It came in two claims that appeared to be one. We, in the process, did not get the second final order out within the 180-day time frame, failing to recognize that it was a separate one from the related claim. Happily, Mr. Chair, a quick phone call and conversation with the claimant resolved that. They were happy to receive their waiver a few days late, but we're not in court on this one. It was just a matter of missing one order on a claim that had two. So next year we will not show 100%. I hope that it shows 99.999%, because I'm hoping we don't miss any more. But again, in this case, I'm pleased to say that a quick phone call to assuage any concern was successful, and the claimant did get their waiver. I will say, though, because this is on the table, I can't guarantee you that we will be at 100%. I've said before, and I will say again in this committee, that based on the volume of claims that came in during the 5 weeks immediately preceding the December 4 change in process, we do not have the capacity under current staffing to get all of those claims out within 180 days, we will start missing the 180-day deadline somewhere in the late April to early May timeframe without some sort of change in process or change in the statute, at least to extend the timeline for processing those claims. So that's a heads up. This is not the first time you've heard it, and I know Representative Clem and Representative Girard have heard me say it in the Joint Committee as well. So that is a concern that we feel, more acutely every day, but I think it is incumbent on me to point that out, that under current staffing, we will not be able to attain 100% or anything close to 100% with the volume of claims that came in that late October to early December period.
20 first, and then we'll come back for questions, since 20 doesn't exist.
Please. Yes, that's right. Number 20 is under development. It's under construction, Mr. Chair, and that is the best practices standard that I think every board and commission is being required to implement. So we have flagged that to the commission, and we'll have that developed for you for the next session.
And my understanding is that's an entirely a new requirement. So that,
Mr. Chair, it is entirely new. And even though we have not got it constructed, I can tell you our target will be 100%.
Okay. Now for questions on 19, which I think there will be a few. But Representative Clem and Representative Berard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just something for the benefit of the record and maybe other committee members who don't sit through Thursday evenings with Representative Girard and I. The consequence in mid-April, without an extension or some legislative decision, once again, is the claimant then sort of loses, if we haven't responded, we haven't gotten their waiver answered yes or no, the claimant's remedy at that point is not automatic waiver, it's instead payment. And the price tag on that for just the 5 weeks worth of additional claims is several billion dollars that then this legislature would duke it out in court first, and then we'd have to pay. And there's no other choice at that point besides you can't waive once you miss the deadline.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, Measure 37 has a very interesting mechanism in it. Well, several, actually. In this one, what it says is that if a regulation continues to apply to the property more than 180 days after a claim has been submitted, the claimant has the right to file a claim for damages plus attorney fees and costs against the government. It goes on to say that if that claim has not, if they've not received compensation within 2 years after the date the claim accrues, and no one's sure exactly what accrues means in the context of the measure, but there's a 2-year period out there somewhere, and at that point, if they've not been paid their damages, attorney fees, and costs, then they do get a waiver to proceed with whatever use would have been permitted at the time of they acquired the property. Interestingly, the measure does not appear under the measure that waiver that then kicks in after this 2-year period does not apparently absolve or resolve the judgment. So apparently at that point, the claimant gets both a waiver and a judgment. But it's our considered hope to avoid ever having to work our way through the detail of just how that plays out.
Representative Gerhard, or Representative Klamath, yeah.
I just wanted to follow up. And so if I heard the date right, the kind of November 1 through December 5 period, there's two time bombs in this building for me. One is the Secure Rural Schools, and this is the other one. And the time bomb here starts going off if there's no extension or other policy decision mid-April?
Mr. Chair, we're actually in the process of sort of calculating, trying to get to a specific date because I know your committee is going to want one. I'm going to say right now that it would be a late April to early May date when we would actually start missing that 180 days. Leading up to that, we will start missing the internal deadlines. Clearly, there'll be a point where they start falling off the conveyor belt. But the 180 days, which actually establishes liability where we fail to get an order out the door, it looks like it's going to be in a late April, early May. The analogy I have for this is the, if you recall the Lucy show, Lucy and Ethel, I think it was, standing at the conveyor belt with the candy moving past them faster and faster and faster. That is starting to happen and will continue to happen with greater frequency as we get to the 180-day deadline. It's at the end of the conveyor belt where we actually accrue that liability, where the candy's not getting off the end.
Any additional representative?
No.
Question, since I'm not fortunate enough to serve on the Measure 37 committee.
Did you use the word fortunate?
Yes, sir. It was sarcasm, Representative Brooks.
And I think I analogized Measure 37 claims to candy,
On the state level, in terms of the approval of claims, once you ascertain that the party has owned the property since the particular date that would be required, do you have to assess at all? I know you do not assess the validity of the financial damages that they say that they have suffered, because you wouldn't be finishing this up for probably another 10 years if you tried to do that. But do you have to assess at all what the pre-existing zoning may have been? Because I know in some jurisdictions there was no zoning, but in other jurisdictions there has been zoning that predates land use planning.
Mr. Chair, yes, and that's a very good question, and part of the complex elements of the claim, because in order to establish a claim, they have to show that their use of the property has been restricted by the enactment or enforcement of a particular regulation. And so for us at the state level, our research on each claim involves not only what was the state law in effect when a claimant acquired the property, but we have to research what was the county zoning in effect when the claimant acquired the property. Because if the county, as you say, and it happens, if the county had zoning that was as restrictive at the time the claimant acquired the property as state law later imposed, or in some cases maybe even more restrictive, we would deny that claim on the basis that the state regulation did not limit the use of that property relative to how it could have been used because of some restriction that was imposed by county zoning. And so we do research not only what was state law at the time of the acquisition of the property, but we need to know what was the county zoning in effect at the time the claimant acquired the property as to each claim. And you're right, there are places in the state where county zoning was more restrictive at points in time. And it changed from year to year and place to place around the state. So each one of these is its own unique little historical survey. But there are places where in the counties zoning was more restrictive than what later became an element of state law.
Yes, Representative Rock.
Lane, during the interim, you were given additional funds to hire additional people to do Measure 37 claims. As I recall, that was a temporary basis. But could you explain where those people are now, what they're doing, and when do they lose their jobs at this point?
Mr. Chair, Representative Girard, those people are on the third floor of my building right now. What they're doing is assessing and evaluating Measure 37 claims and writing Measure 37 reports. And you are correct. Legislature last session gave us some, and then I think by e-board action in June we got approval for additional staff based on what we then knew as the volume of claims coming in the door, knowing that we would be getting a surge but not having any way to anticipate what our staffing would need to be for that. But those folks are limited duration positions. Their position authority ends on June 30. And so that is why we have a Measure 37 policy option package to continue funding for that Measure 37 claim staff.
Folks in the governor's budget, that's the people that are already there and hired, not additional.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
and the additional. At this point, I think we will adjourn for today, and then tomorrow we will have public testimony. I think we still have to go through priorities, 2%, and continuous improvement. And then we will be... and policy packages.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah. Thank you.
I think you're fairly well off in terms of policy packages, not that they will be approved,
yeah,
but that you don't have 31 of them.
We don't have a lot. There's not a lot to say about them, but we will answer any questions you might have. Thank you,
Mr. Chair.